This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents An Anthropologist on Mars, Seven Paradoxical Tales, written by Oliver Sacks, narrated by Jonathan Davis and Oliver Sacks.
I am Oliver Sacks. Nature's imagination, as Freeman Dyson likes to say, is richer than ours. And he speaks marvelingly of this richness in the physical and biological worlds, the endless diversity of physical forms and forms of life. For me, as a physician, nature's richness is to be studied in the phenomena of health and disease, in the endless forms of individual adaptation by which human organisms, people, adapt and reconstruct themselves, faced with the challenges and vicissitudes of life. Defects, disorders, diseases, in this sense, can play a paradoxical role by bringing out latent powers, developments, evolutions, forms of life that might never be seen or even be imaginable in their absence. It is the paradox of disease, its creative potential, that forms the central theme of this book. Thus, while one may be horrified by the ravages of developmental disorders or disease, one may sometimes see them as creative too. For if they destroy particular paths, particular ways of doing things, they may force the nervous system into making other paths and other ways, force on it an unexpected growth and evolution. This other side of disease is something I see, potentially, in almost every patient, and it is this which I am especially concerned to describe here. That such radical adaptations could occur demands a new view of the brain, a sense of it not as programmed and static, but rather as dynamic and active, a supremely efficient adaptive system geared for evolution and change, ceaselessly adapting to the needs of the organism, its need, above all, to construct a coherent self and world, whatever defects or disorders of brain function befall it. That the brain is minutely differentiated is clear. There are hundreds of tiny areas crucial for every aspect of perception and behaviour, from the perception of colour and of motion to perhaps the intellectual orientation of the individual. The miracle is how they all cooperate, are integrated together in the creation of a self. This sense of the brain's remarkable plasticity, its capacity for the most striking adaptations, not least in the special and often desperate circumstances of neural or sensory mishap, has come to dominate my own perception of my patients and their lives. So much so, indeed, that I am sometimes moved to wonder whether it may not be necessary to redefine the very concepts of health and disease. To see these in terms of the ability of the organism to create a new organization and order, one that fits its special, altered disposition and needs, rather than in the terms of a rigidly defined norm. Sickness implies a contraction of life, but such contractions do not have to occur. Nearly all of my patients, so it seems to me, whatever their problems, reach out to life, and not only despite their conditions, but often because of them, and even with their aid. Here, then, are seven narratives of nature and the human spirit, as these have collided in unexpected ways. The people in this book have been visited by neurological conditions as diverse as Tourette syndrome, autism, amnesia, and total colour blindness. They exemplify these conditions. They are cases in the traditional medical sense, but equally they are unique individuals, each of whom inhabits and in a sense has created a world of his own. These are tales of survival, survival under altered, sometimes radically altered, conditions. Survival made possible by the wonderful but sometimes dangerous powers of reconstruction and adaptation we have. In earlier books, I wrote of the preservation of self, and more rarely of the loss of self in neurological disorders. I have come to think that these terms are too simple, and that there is neither loss nor preservation of identity in such situations, but rather its adaptation, even its transmutation, given a radically altered brain and reality. The study of disease for the physician demands the study of identity, the inner worlds that patients under the spur of illness create. But the realities of patients, the ways in which they and their brains construct their own worlds, cannot be comprehended wholly from the observation of behaviour, from the outside. In addition to the objective approach of the scientist, the naturalist, we must employ an intersubjective approach too, leaping, as Foucault writes, into the interior of morbid consciousness, trying to see the pathological world with the eyes of the patient himself. The exploration of deeply altered selves and worlds is not one that can be fully made in a consulting room or office. The French neurologist François Lhermitte is especially sensitive to this, and instead of just observing his patients in the clinic, he makes a point of visiting them at home, taking them to restaurants or theatres, or for rides in his car, sharing their lives as much as possible. It is similar, or was similar, with physicians in general practice. Thus, when my father was reluctantly considering retirement at 90, we said, "At least drop the house calls." But he answered, "No, I'll keep the house calls. I'll drop everything else instead." With this in mind, I have taken off my white coat, deserted by and large the hospitals where I've spent the last 35 years, to explore my subjects' lives as they live in the real world, feeling in part like a naturalist examining rare forms of life, in part like an anthropologist, a neuroanthropologist in the field, but most of all like a physician called here and there to make house calls at the far borders of human experience. The seven tales that follow are all, in a way, extended house calls.
The universe is not only queerer than we imagine, but queerer than we can imagine. J.B.S. Haldane. Ask not what disease the person has, but rather what person the disease has. Attributed to William Osler. Preface. I am writing this with my left hand, although I am strongly right-handed. I had surgery to my right shoulder a month ago, and I'm not permitted, not capable of, use of the right arm at this time. I write slowly, awkwardly, but more easily, more naturally with each passing day. I am adapting, learning all the while, not merely this left-handed writing, but a dozen other left-handed skills as well. I have also become very adept, prehensile, with my toes, to compensate for having one arm in a sling. I was quite off balance for a few days when the arm was first immobilized, but now I walk differently. I have discovered a new balance. I am developing different patterns, different habits, a different identity, one might say, at least in this particular sphere. There must be changes going on with some of the programs and circuits in my brain, altering synaptic weights and connectivities and signals, though our methods of brain imaging are still too crude to show these. Though some of my adaptations are deliberate, planned, and some are learned through trial and error, in the first week I injured every finger of my left hand. Most have occurred by themselves, unconsciously, by reprogrammings and adaptations of which I know nothing, any more than I know or can know how I normally walk. Next month, if all goes well, I can start to readapt again, to regain a full and natural use of the right arm, to reincorporate it back into my body image, myself, to become a dexterous, dextral human being once again. But recovery in such circumstances is by no means automatic. A simple process like tissue healing, it will involve a whole nexus of muscular and postural adjustments, a whole sequence of new procedures, and their synthesis, learning, finding a new path to recovery. My surgeon, an understanding man who has had the same operation himself, said there are general guidelines, restrictions, recommendations, but all the particulars you will have to find out for yourself. Jay, my physiotherapist, expressed himself similarly. Adaptation follows a different path in each person. The nervous system creates its own paths. You're the neurologist. You must see this all the time. Nature's imagination, as Freeman Dyson likes to say, is richer than ours. And he speaks marvelingly of this richness in the physical and biological worlds, the endless diversity of physical forms and forms of life. For me, as a physician, nature's richness is to be studied in the phenomena of health and disease, in the endless forms of individual adaptation by which human organisms, people, adapt and reconstruct themselves, faced with the challenges and vicissitudes of life. Defects, disorders, diseases, in this sense, can play a paradoxical role by bringing out latent powers, developments, evolutions, forms of life that might never be seen or even be imaginable in their absence. It is the paradox of disease in this sense, its creative potential that forms the central theme of this book. Thus, while one may be horrified by the ravages of developmental disorder or disease, one may sometimes see them as creative too. For if they destroy particular paths, particular ways of doing things, they may force the nervous system into making other paths and ways, force on it an unexpected growth in evolution. This other side of development or disease is something I see potentially in almost every patient. And it is this here which I am especially concerned to describe. Similar considerations were brought up by A.R. Luria, who more than any other neurologist in his lifetime studied the long-term survival of patients who had cerebral tumors or had suffered brain injuries or strokes, and the ways, the adaptations they used to survive. He also studied deaf and blind children as a very young man with his mentor L.S. Vygotsky. Vygotsky stressed the intactness rather than the deficits of such children. A handicapped child represents a qualitatively different, unique type of development. If a blind or deaf child achieves the same level of development as a normal child, then the child with a defect achieves this in another way, by another course, by other means. And for the pedagogue, it is particularly important to know the uniqueness of the course along which he must lead the child. This uniqueness transforms the minus of the handicap into the plus of compensation. That such radical adaptations could occur demanded, Luria thought, a new view of the brain, a sense of it not as programmed and static, but rather as dynamic and active, a supremely efficient adaptive system geared for evolution and change, ceaselessly adapting to the needs of the organism. Its need, above all, to construct a coherent self and world, whatever defects and disorders of brain function befell it. That the brain is minutely differentiated is clear. There are hundreds of tiny areas crucial for every aspect of perception and behavior, from the perception of color and of motion to perhaps the intellectual orientation of the individual. The miracle is how they all cooperate, are integrated together in the creation of a self. This sense of the brain's remarkable plasticity, its capacity for the most striking adaptations, not least in the special and often desperate circumstances of neural or sensory mishap, has come to dominate my own perception of my patients and their lives. So much so, indeed, that I am sometimes moved to wonder whether it may not be necessary to redefine the very concepts of health and disease, to see these in terms of the ability of the organism to create a new organization and order, one that fits its special, altered disposition and needs, rather than in the terms of a rigidly defined norm. Sickness implies a contraction of life, but such contractions do not have to occur. Nearly all of my patients, so it seems to me, whatever their problems, reach out to life, and not only despite their conditions, but often because of them, and even with their aid. Here, then, are seven narratives of nature and the human spirit, as these have collided in unexpected ways. The people in this book have been visited by neurological conditions as diverse as Tourette syndrome, autism, amnesia, and total colorblindness. They exemplify these conditions. They are cases in the traditional medical sense, but equally, they are unique individuals, each of whom inhabits, and in a sense has created, a world of his own. These are tales of survival, survival under altered, sometimes radically altered conditions, survival made possible by the wonderful but sometimes dangerous powers of reconstruction and adaptation we have. In earlier books I wrote of the preservation of self, and, more rarely, of the loss of self in neurological disorders. I have to come to think these terms too simple, and that there is neither loss nor preservation of identity in such situations, but rather its adaptation, even its transmutation, given a radically altered brain and reality. The study of disease for the physician demands the study of identity, the inner worlds that patients under the spur of illness create. But the realities of patients, the ways in which they and their brains construct their own worlds, cannot be comprehended wholly from the observation of behavior, from the outside. In addition to the objective approach of the scientist, the naturalist, we must employ an intersubjective approach too, leaping, as Foucault writes, into the interior of morbid consciousness, trying to see the pathological world with the eyes of the patient himself. No one has written better of the nature and necessity of such intuition or empathy than G.K. Chesterton, through the mouth of his spiritual detective, Father Brown. Thus, when Father Brown is asked for his method, his secret, he replies, "Science is a grand thing when you can get it. In its real sense, one of the grandest words in the world. But what do these men mean 9 times out of 10 when they use it nowadays? When they say detection is a science, when they say criminology is a science, they mean getting outside a man and studying him as if he were a gigantic insect, in what they would call a dry, impartial light, in what I should call a dead and dehumanized light. They mean getting a long way off him as if he were a distant prehistoric monster, staring at the shape of his criminal skull, as if it were a sort of eerie growth, like the horn on a rhinoceros's nose. When the scientist talks about a type, he never means himself, but always his neighbor, probably his poorer neighbor. I don't deny the dry light may sometimes do good, though in one sense it's the very reverse of science. So far from being knowledge, it's actually suppression of what we know. It's treating a friend as a stranger and pretending that something familiar is really remote and mysterious. It's like saying that a man has a proboscis between the eyes, or that he falls down in a fit of insensibility once every 24 hours. Well, what you call the secret is exactly the opposite. I don't try to get outside the man. I try to get inside. The exploration of deeply altered selves and worlds is not one that can be fully made in a consulting room or office. The French neurologist François Lhermitte is especially sensitive to this, and instead of just observing his patients in the clinic, he makes a point of visiting them at home, taking them to restaurants or theaters, or for rides in his car, sharing their lives as much as possible. It is similar, or was similar, with physicians in general practice. Thus, when my father was reluctantly considering retirement at 90, we said, "At least drop the house calls." But he answered, "No, I'll keep the house calls. I'll drop everything else instead." With this in mind, I have taken off my white coat, deserted by and large the hospitals where I've spent the last 25 years, to explore my subjects' lives as they live in the real world, feeling in part like a naturalist, examining rare forms of life, in part like an anthropologist, a neuroanthropologist in the field, but most of all like a physician, called here and there to make house calls at the far borders of human experience. These then are tales of metamorphosis, brought about by neurological chance, but metamorphosis into alternative states of being, other forms of life, no less human for being so different. O.W.S., New York, June 1994. The Case of the Colorblind Painter. Early in March 1986, I received the following letter. I am a rather successful artist, just past 65 years of age. On January 2nd of this year, I was driving my car and was hit by a small truck on the passenger side of my vehicle. When visiting the emergency room of a local hospital, I was told I had a concussion. While taking an eye examination, it was discovered that I was unable to distinguish letters or colors. The letters appeared to be Greek letters. My vision was such that everything appeared to me as viewing a black-and-white television screen. Within days, I could distinguish letters, and my vision became that of an eagle. I can see a worm wriggling a block away. The sharpness of focus is incredible. But I am absolutely colorblind. I have visited ophthalmologists who know nothing about this colorblind business. I have visited neurologists to no avail. Under hypnosis, I still can't distinguish colors. I have been involved in all kinds of tests, you name it. My brown dog is dark gray. Tomato juice is black. Color TV is a hodgepodge. Had I ever encountered such a problem before? The writer continued. Could I explain what was happening to him? And could I help? This seemed an extraordinary letter. Color blindness, as ordinarily understood, is something one is born with, a difficulty distinguishing red and green or other colors, or extremely rarely, an inability to see any colors at all, due to defects in the color-responding cells, the cones of the retina. But clearly this was not the case with my correspondent, Jonathan I. He had seen normally all his life, had been born with a full complement of cones in his retinas. He had become colorblind after 65 years of seeing colors normally, totally colorblind, as if viewing a black-and-white television screen. The suddenness of the event was incompatible with any of the slow deteriorations that can befall the retinal cone cells, and suggested instead a mishap at a much higher level in those parts of the brain specialized for the perception of color. Total color blindness caused by brain damage, so-called cerebral achromatopsia, though described more than three centuries ago, remains a rare and important condition. It has intrigued neurologists because, like all neural dissolutions and destructions, it can reveal to us the mechanisms of neural construction. Specifically here, how the brain sees or makes color. Doubly intriguing is its occurrence in an artist, a painter for whom color has been of primary importance, and who can directly paint as well as describe what has befallen him, and thus convey the full strangeness, distress, and reality of the condition. Color is not a trivial subject, but one that has compelled for hundreds of years a passionate curiosity in the greatest artists, philosophers, and natural scientists. The young Spinoza wrote his first treatise on the rainbow. The young Newton's most joyous discovery was the composition of white light. Goethe's great color work, like Newton, started with a prism. Schopenhauer, Young, Helmholtz, and Maxwell in the last century were all tantalized by the problem of color. And Wittgenstein's last work was his Remarks on Color. And yet, most of us, most of the time, overlook its great mystery. Through such a case as Mr. I's, we can trace not only the underlying cerebral mechanisms or physiology, but the phenomenology of color and the depth of its resonance and meaning for the individual. On getting Mr. I's letter, I contacted my good friend and colleague Robert Wasserman, an ophthalmologist, feeling that together we needed to explore Mr. I's complex situation and if we could help him. We first saw him in April 1986. He was a tall, gaunt man with a sharp, intelligent face. Although obviously depressed by his condition, he soon warmed to us and began talking with animation and humor. He constantly smoked as he talked. His fingers, restless, were stained with nicotine. He described a very active and productive life as an artist, from his early days with Georgia O'Keeffe in New Mexico, to painting backdrops in Hollywood during the 1940s, to working as an abstract expressionist in New York during the 1950s, and later as an art director and a commercial artist. We learned that his accident had been accompanied by a transient amnesia. He had been able, evidently, to give a clear account of himself and his accident to the police at the time it happened, late on the afternoon of January 2nd, but then, because of a steadily mounting headache, he went home. He complained to his wife of having a headache and feeling confused, but made no mention of the accident. He then fell into a long, almost stuporous sleep. It was only the next morning, when his wife saw the side of the car stove in, that she asked him what had happened. When she got no clear answer, "I don't know, maybe somebody backed into it," she knew that something serious must have happened. Mr. I then drove off to his studio and found on his desk a carbon copy of the police accident report. He had had an accident, but somehow bizarrely had lost his memory of it. Perhaps the report would jolt his memory. But lifting it up, he could make nothing of it. He saw print of different sizes and types, all clearly in focus, but it looked like Greek or Hebrew to him. A magnifying glass did not help, it simply became large Greek or Hebrew. I asked Mr. I later if he knew Greek or Hebrew. He said no, there was just the sense of an unintelligible foreign language. Perhaps, he added, cuneiform would be more accurate. He saw forms. He knew they had to have meaning, but could not imagine what this meaning might be. Dyslexia, or inability to read, lasted for 5 days, but then disappeared. Feeling now that he must have suffered a stroke or some sort of brain damage from the accident, Jonathan I phoned his doctor, who arranged for him to be tested at a local hospital. Although, as his original letter indicates, difficulties in distinguishing colors were detected at this time, in addition to his inability to read, he had no subjective sense of the alteration of colors until the next day. That day he decided to go to work again. It seemed to him as if he were driving in a fog, even though he knew it to be a bright and sunny morning. Everything seemed misty, bleached, grayish, indistinct. He was flagged down by the police close to his studio. He had gone through 2 red lights, they said. Did he realize this? No, he said. He was not aware of having passed through any red lights. They asked him to get out of the car. Finding him sober, but apparently bewildered and ill, they gave him a ticket and suggested he seek medical advice. Mr. I arrived at his studio with relief, expecting that the horrible mist would be gone, that everything would be clear again. But as soon as he entered, he found his entire studio, which was hung with brilliantly colored paintings, now utterly gray and void of color. His canvases, the abstract color paintings he was known for, were now grayish or black and white. His paintings, once rich with associations, feelings, meanings, now looked unfamiliar and meaningless to him. At this point, the magnitude of his loss overwhelmed him. He had spent his life as a painter. Now, even his art was without meaning, and he could no longer imagine how to go on. The weeks that followed were very difficult. "You might think," Mr. I said, "loss of color vision, what's the big deal? Some of my friends said this. My wife sometimes thought this. But to me, at least, it was awful. Disgusting." He knew the colors of everything with an extraordinary exactness. He could give not only the names, but the numbers of colors, as these were listed in a Pantone chart of hues he had used for many years. He could identify the green of Van Gogh's billiard table in this way unhesitatingly. He knew all the colors in his favorite paintings, but could no longer see them, either when he looked or in his mind's eye. Perhaps he knew them now only by verbal memory. It was not just the colors were missing, but that what he did see had a distasteful, dirty look, the whites glaring yet discolored and off-white, the blacks cavernous, everything wrong, unnatural, stained, and impure. Mr. I could hardly bear the changed appearances of people, like animated gray statues, any more than he could bear his own appearance in the mirror. He shunned social intercourse and found sexual intercourse impossible. He saw people's flesh, his wife's flesh, his own flesh, as an abhorrent gray. Flesh-colored now appeared rat-colored to him. This was so even when he closed his eyes. For his vivid visual imagery was preserved, but was now without color as well. The wrongness of everything was disturbing, even disgusting, and applied to every circumstance of daily life. He found foods disgusting due to their grayish, dead appearance, and had to close his eyes to eat. But this did not help very much, for the mental image of a tomato was as black as its appearance. Thus, unable to rectify even the inner image, the idea of various foods, he turned increasingly to black and white foods, to black olives and white rice, black coffee and yogurt. These at least appeared relatively normal, whereas most foods, normally colored, now appeared horribly abnormal. His own brown dog looked so strange to him now that he even considered getting a Dalmatian. He encountered difficulties and distresses of every sort, from the confusion of red and green traffic lights, which he could now distinguish only by position, to an inability to choose his clothes. His wife had to pick them out, and this dependency he found hard to bear. Later he had everything classified in his drawers and closet, gray socks here, yellow there, ties labeled, jackets and suits categorized, to prevent otherwise glaring incongruities and confusions. Fixed and ritualistic practices and positions had to be adopted at the table, otherwise he might mistake the mustard for the mayonnaise, or if he could bring himself to use the blackish stuff, ketchup for jam. As the months went by, he particularly missed the brilliant colors of spring. He had always loved flowers, but now he could only distinguish them by shape or smell. The blue jays were brilliant no longer. Their blue, curiously, was now seen as pale gray. He could no longer see the clouds in the sky, their whiteness or off-whiteness as he saw them being scarcely distinguishable from the azure, which seemed bleached to a pale gray. Red and green peppers were also indistinguishable, but this was because both appeared black. Yellows and blues to him were almost white. Mr. I also seemed to experience an excessive tonal contrast, with loss of delicate tonal gradations, especially in direct sunlight or harsh artificial light. He made a comparison here with the effects of sodium lighting, which at once removes color and tonal delicacy, and with certain black and white films, like Tri-X pushed for speed, which produce a harsh contrasty effect. Sometimes objects stood out with inordinate contrast and sharpness, like silhouettes. But if the contrast was normal or low, they might disappear from sight altogether. Thus, though his brown dog would stand out sharply in silhouette against the light road, it might get lost to sight when it moved into soft, dappled undergrowth. People's figures might be visible and recognizable half a mile off. As he himself said in his original letter and many times later, his vision had become much sharper, that of an eagle, but faces would often be unidentifiable until they were close. This seemed a matter of lost color and tonal contrast, rather than a defect in recognition, anagnosia. A major problem occurred when he drove, in that he tended to misinterpret shadows as cracks or ruts in the road, and would break or swerve suddenly to avoid these. He found color television especially hard to bear, its images always unpleasant, sometimes unintelligible. Black and white television, he thought, was much easier to deal with. He felt his perception of black and white images to be relatively normal, whereas something bizarre and intolerable occurred whenever he looked at colored images. When we asked why he did not simply turn off the color, he said he thought that the tonal values of decolored color TV seemed different, less normal than those of a pure black-and-white set. But as he now explained in distinction to his first letter, his world was not really like black-and-white television or film. It would have been much easier to live with had it been so. He sometimes wished he could wear miniature TV glasses. His despair of conveying what his world looked like, and the uselessness of the usual black-and-white analogies, finally drove him some weeks later to create an entire gray room, a gray universe in his studio, in which tables, chairs, and an elaborate dinner ready for serving were all painted in a range of grays. The effect of this, in three dimensions and in a different tonal scale from the black and white we are all accustomed to, was indeed macabre, and wholly unlike that of a black and white photograph. As Mr. I pointed out, we accept black and white photographs or films because they are representations of the world, images that we can look at or away from when we want. But black and white for him was a reality. All around him, 360 degrees, solid and three-dimensional, 24 hours a day. The only way he could express it, he felt, was to make a completely gray room for others to experience. But of course, he pointed out, the observer himself would have to be painted gray. So he would be part of the world, not just observing it. More than this, the observer would have to lose, as he himself had, the neural knowledge of color. It was, he said, like living in a world molded in lead. Subsequently, he said neither gray nor leaden could begin to convey what his world was actually like. It was not gray that he experienced, he said, but perceptual qualities for which ordinary experience, ordinary language, had no equivalent. Mr. I could no longer bear to go to museums and galleries or to see colored reproductions of his favorite pictures. This was not just because they were bereft of color, but because they looked intolerably wrong, with washed out or unnatural shades of gray. Photographs in black and white, on the other hand, were much more tolerable. This was especially distressing when he knew the artists and the perceptual debasement of their work interfered with his sense of their identity. This indeed was what he now felt was happening with himself. He was depressed once by a rainbow, which he saw only as a colorless semicircle in the sky. And he even felt his occasional migraines as dull. Previously, they had involved brilliantly colored geometric hallucinations, but now even these were devoid of color. He sometimes tried to evoke color by pressing the globes of his eyes, but the flashes and patterns elicited were equally lacking in color. He had often dreamed in vivid color, especially when he dreamed of landscapes and painting. Now his dreams were washed out and pale, or violent and contrasty, lacking both color and delicate tonal gradations. Music, curiously, was impaired for him too, because he had previously had an extremely intense synesthesia, so that different tones had immediately been translated into color, and he experienced all music simultaneously as a rich tumult of inner colors. With the loss of his ability to generate colors, he lost this ability as well. His internal color organ was out of action, and now he heard music with no visual accompaniment. This for him was music with its essential chromatic counterpart missing. Music now radically impoverished. Only one sense could give him any real pleasure at this time, and this was the sense of smell. Mr. I had always had a most acute, erotically charged sense of smell. Indeed, he ran a small perfume business on the side, compounding his own scents. As the pleasures of seeing were lost, the pleasures of smell were heightened, or so it seemed to him, in the first grim weeks after his accident. A certain mild pleasure came from looking at drawings. He had been a fine draftsman in his earlier years. Could he not go back to drawing again? This thought was slow to occur to him, and it only took hold after being suggested repeatedly by others. His own first impulse was to paint in color. He insisted that he still knew what colors to use, even though he could no longer see them. He decided, as a first exercise, to paint flowers, taking from his palette what tints seemed tonally right. But the pictures were unintelligible, a confusing welter of colors to normal eyes. It was only when one of his artist friends took black-and-white Polaroids of the paintings that they made sense. The contours were accurate, but the colors were all wrong. "No one will get your paintings," one of his friends said, "unless they are as colorblind as you." "Stop pushing it," said another. "You can't use color now." Mr. I reluctantly allowed all his colored paints to be put away. "It's only temporary," he thought. "I'll be back to color soon." These first weeks were a time of agitation, even desperation. He was constantly hoping that he would wake up one fine morning and find the world of color miraculously restored. This was a constant motif in his dreams at the time. But the wish was never fulfilled, even in his dreams. He would dream that he was about to see in color, but then he would wake and find that nothing had changed. He constantly feared that whatever had happened would happen again, this time depriving him of all his sight completely. He thought he had probably had a stroke, caused by or perhaps causing his accident in the car, and feared that there could be another stroke at any moment. In addition to this medical fear, there was a deeper bewilderment and fear that he found almost impossible to articulate. And it was this that had come to a head in his month of attempted color painting, his month of insisting that he still knew color. It had gradually come upon him during this time that it was not merely color perception and color imagery that he lacked, but something deeper and difficult to define. He knew all about color, externally, intellectually, but he had lost the remembrance, the inner knowledge of it that had been part of his very being. He had had a lifetime of experience in color, but now this was only a historical fact, not something he could access and feel directly. It was as if his past, his chromatic past, had been taken away, as if the brain's knowledge of color had been totally excised, leaving no trace, no inner evidence of its existence behind. By the beginning of February, some of his agitation was calming down. He had started to accept, not merely intellectually, but at a deeper level too, that he was indeed totally colorblind, and might possibly remain so. His initial sense of helplessness started to give way to a sense of resolution. He would paint in black and white. If he could not paint in color, he would try to live in a black and white world as fully as he could. This resolution was strengthened by a singular experience about 5 weeks after his accident as he was driving to the studio one morning. He saw the sun rise over the highway. The blazing reds all turned into black. "The sun rose like a bomb, like some enormous nuclear explosion," he said later. Had anyone ever seen a sunrise in this way before? Inspired by the sunrise, he started painting again. He started, indeed, with a black-and-white painting that he called Nuclear Sunrise, and then went on to the abstracts he favored, but now painting in black-and-white only. The fear of blindness continued to haunt him, but creatively transmuted, shaped the first real paintings he did after his color experiments. Black-and-white paintings he now found he could do, and do very well. He found his only solace working in the studio, and he worked 15, even 18 hours a day. This meant for him a kind of artistic survival. "I felt if I couldn't go on painting," he said later, "I wouldn't want to go on at all." His first black-and-white paintings, done in February and March, gave a feeling of violent forces, rage, fear, despair, excitement. but these were held in control, attesting to the powers of artistry that could disclose and yet contain such intensity of feeling. In these 2 months, he produced dozens of paintings marked by a singular style, a character he had never shown before. In many of these paintings, there was an extraordinary shattered kaleidoscopic surface, with abstract shapes suggestive of faces, averted, shadowed, sorrowing, raging, and dismembered body parts, faceted and held in frames and boxes. They had compared with his previous work a labyrinthine complexity and an obsessed, haunted quality. They seemed to exhibit in symbolic form the predicament he was in. Starting in May, it was fascinating to watch. He moved from these powerful but rather terrifying and alien paintings toward themes, living themes he had not touched in 30 years, back to representational paintings of dancers and racehorses. These paintings, even though still in black and white, were full of movement, vitality, and sensuousness, and they went with a change in his personal life, a lessening of his withdrawal, and the beginnings of a renewed social and sexual life, a lessening of his fears and depression, and a turning back to life. At this time, too, he turned to sculpture, which he had never done before. He seemed to be turning to all the visual modes that still remained to him, form, contour, movement, depth, and exploring them with heightened intensity. He also started painting portraits, although he found that he could not work from life, but only from black and white photographs, fortified by his knowledge of and feeling for each subject. Life was tolerable only in the studio, for here he could reconceive the world in powerful, stark forms. But outside, in real life, he found the world alien, empty, dead, and gray. This was the story Bob Wasserman and I got from Mr. I, a story of an abrupt and total breakdown of color vision and his attempts to live in a black-and-white world. I had never been given such a history before. I had never met anyone with total color blindness before, and I had no idea what had happened to him, nor whether his condition could be reversed or improved. The first thing was to define his impairments more precisely with various tests, some quite informal, making use of everyday objects or pictures, whatever came to hand. For instance, we first asked Mr. I about a shelf of notebooks, blue, red, and black, by my desk. He instantly picked out the blue ones, a bright medium blue to normal eyes. They're pale. The red and the black were indistinguishable. Both, for him, were dead black. We then gave him a large mass of yarns containing 33 separate colors and asked him to sort these. He said he could not sort them by color, but only by grayscale tonal values. He then rapidly and easily separated the yarns into four strange chromatically random piles, which he characterized as 0 to 25%, 25 to 50%, 50 to 75% and 75 to 100% on a gray tone scale. Though nothing looked to him purely white, and even white yarn looked slightly dingy or dirty. We ourselves could not confirm the accuracy of this because our color vision interfered with our ability to visualize a gray scale, just as normally sighted viewers had been unable to perceive the tonal sense of his confusingly polychromatic flower paintings. But a black-and-white photograph and a black-and-white video camera confirmed that Mr. I had indeed accurately divided the colored yarns in a gray scale that basically coincided with their own mechanical reading. There was perhaps a certain crudeness in his categories, but this went with the sense of sharp contrast, the paucity of tonal gradations that he had complained of. Indeed, when shown an artist's grayscale of perhaps a dozen gradations from black to white, Mr. I could distinguish only three or four categories of tone. We also showed him the classic Ishihara colored dot plates, in which configurations of numerals and subtly differentiated colors may stand out clearly for the normally sighted, but not for those with various types of color blindness. Mr. I was unable to see any of these figures, although he was able to see certain plates that are visible to the colorblind, but not to normally sighted people, and thus designed to catch pretended or hysterical colorblindness. We happen to have a postcard that could have been designed for testing achromatopes. A postcard of a coastal scene with fishermen on a jetty silhouetted against a dark red sunset sky. Mr. I was totally unable to see the fishermen or the jetty, and saw only the half-engulfed hemisphere of the setting sun. Though such problems arose when he was shown colored pictures, Mr. I had no difficulty describing black-and-white photographs or reproductions accurately. He had no difficulty recognizing forms. His imagery and memory of objects and pictures shown to him were indeed exceptionally vivid and accurate, though always colorless. Thus, after being given a classic test picture of a colored boat, he looked intensely, looked away, and then rapidly reproduced it in black and white paint. When asked the colors of familiar objects, he had no difficulties in color association or color naming. Patients with color anomia, for instance, can match colors perfectly, but have lost the names of colors and might speak uncertainly of a banana being blue. A patient with a color agnosia, by contrast, could also match colors, but would evince no surprise if given a blue banana. Mr. I, however, had neither of these problems. Nor did he now have any difficulties reading. Testing up to this point, and a general neurological examination, thus confirmed Mr. I's total achromatopsia. We could say to him at this point that his problem was real, that he had a true achromatopsia and not a hysteria. He took this, we thought, with mixed feelings. He had half hoped it might be merely a hysteria, and as such potentially reversible. But the notion of something psychological had also distressed him and made him feel that his problem was not real. Indeed, several doctors had hinted at this. Our testing, in a sense, legitimized his condition, but deepened his fear about brain damage and the prognosis for recovery. Although it seemed that he had an achromatopsia of cerebral origin, we could not help wondering whether a lifetime of heavy smoking could have played a part. Nicotine can cause a dimming of vision, an amblyopia, and sometimes an achromatopsia, but this is predominantly due to its effects on the cells of the retina. But the major problem was clearly cerebral. Mr. I could have sustained tiny areas of brain damage as a result of his concussion. He could have had a small stroke, either following or conceivably precipitating the accident. The history of our knowledge about the brain's ability to represent color has followed a complex and zigzag course. Newton, in his famous prism experiment in 1666, showed that white light was composite, could be decomposed into and recomposed by all the colors of the spectrum. The rays that were bent most, the most refrangible, were seen as violet, the least refrangible as red, with the rest of the spectrum in between. The colors of objects, Newton thought, were determined by the copiousness with which they reflected particular rays to the eye. Thomas Young, in 1802, feeling that there was no need to have an infinity of different receptors in the eye, each tuned to a different wavelength. Artists, after all, could create almost any color they wanted by using a very limited palette of paints, postulated that three types of receptors would be enough. Young's brilliant idea, thrown off casually in the course of a lecture, was forgotten or lay dormant for 50 years until Hermann von Helmholtz, in the course of his own investigation of vision, resurrected it and gave it a new precision, so that we now speak of the Young-Helmholtz hypothesis. For Helmholtz, as for Young, Color was a direct expression of the wavelengths of light absorbed by each receptor, the nervous system just translating one into the other. Red light stimulates the red sensitive fibers strongly and the other two weakly, giving the sensation red. In 1884, Hermann Willebrand, seeing in his neurological practice patients with a range of visual losses, in some predominantly the loss of visual field, in others predominantly of color perception, and in still others predominantly of form perception, suggested that there must be separate visual centers in the primary visual cortex for light impressions, color impressions, and form impressions, though he had no anatomical evidence for this. That achromatopsia, and even hemiachromatopsia, could indeed arise from damage to specific parts of the brain was first confirmed 4 years later by a Swiss ophthalmologist, Louis Verret. He described a 60-year-old woman who, in consequence of a stroke affecting the occipital lobe of her left hemisphere, now saw everything in the right half of her visual field in shades of gray. The left half remained normally colored. The opportunity to examine his patient's brain after her death showed damage confined to a small portion, the fusiform and lingual gyri of the visual cortex. It was here, Verret concluded, that the center for chromatic sense will be found. That such a center might exist, that any part of the cortex might be specialized for the perceptional representation of color, was immediately contested and continued to be contested for almost a century. The grounds of this contention go very deep as the philosophy of neurology itself. Locke, in the 17th century, had held to a sensationalist philosophy, which paralleled Newton's physicalist one. Our senses are measuring instruments, recording the external world for us in terms of sensation. Hearing, seeing, all sensation he took to be wholly passive and receptive. Neurologists in the late 19th century were quick to accept this philosophy and to embed it in a speculative anatomy of the brain. Visual perception was equated with sense data, or impressions, transmitted from the retina to the primary visual area of the brain in an exact point-to-point correspondence, and there experienced subjectively as an image of the visual world. Color, it was presumed, was an integral part of this image. There was no room, anatomically, it was thought, for a separate color center, or indeed, conceptually, for the very idea of one. Thus, when Verret published his findings in 1888, they flew in the face of accepted doctrine. His observations were doubted, his testing criticized, his examination regarded as flawed. But the real objection behind these was doctrinal in nature. If there was no discrete color center, so the thinking went, there could be no isolated achromatopsia either. Thus, Verret's case and two similar ones in the 1890s were dismissed from neurological consciousness. And cerebral achromatopsia, as a subject, all but disappeared for the next 75 years. There was not to be another full case study until 1974. Mr. I himself was actively curious about what was going on in his brain. Though he now lived wholly in a world of lightnesses and darknesses, he was very struck by how these changed in different illuminations. Red objects, for instance, which normally appeared black to him, became lighter in the long rays of the evening sun. And this allowed him to infer their redness. This phenomenon was very marked if the quality of illumination suddenly changed, as, for example, when a fluorescent light was turned on, which would cause an immediate change in the brightnesses of objects around the room. Mr. I commented that he now found himself in an inconstant world, a world whose lights and darks fluctuated with the wavelength of illumination. In striking contrast to the relative stability, the constancy of the color world he had previously known. All of this, of course, is very difficult to explain in terms of classical color theory. Newton's notion of an invariant relationship between wavelength and color, of a cell-to-cell transmission of wavelength information from the retina to the brain, and of a direct conversion of this information into color. Such a simple process, a neurological analogy to the decomposition and recomposition of light through a prism, could hardly account for the complexity of color perception in real life. This incompatibility between classical color theory and reality struck Goethe in the late 18th century. Intensely aware of the phenomenal reality of colored shadows and colored afterimages, of the effects of contiguity and illumination on the appearance of colors, of colored and other visual illusions, he felt that these must be the basis of a color theory and declared as his credo, "Optical illusion is optical truth." Goethe was centrally concerned with the way we actually see colors and light, the ways in which we create worlds and illusions in color. This, he felt, was not explicable by Newton's physics, but only by some as yet unknown rules of the brain. He was saying, in effect, visual illusion is neurological truth. Goethe's color theory, which he regarded as the equal of his entire poetic opus, was by and large dismissed by all his contemporaries and has remained in a sort of limbo ever since, seen as the whimsy, the pseudoscience of a very great poet. But science itself was not entirely insensitive to the anomalies that Goethe considered central, and Helmholtz indeed gave admiring lectures on Goethe and his science on many occasions, the last in 1892. Helmholtz was very conscious of color constancy, the way in which the colors of objects are preserved, so that we can categorize them and always know what we are looking at, despite great fluctuations in the wavelength of the light illuminating them. The actual wavelengths reflected by an apple, for instance, will vary considerably depending on the illumination. But we consistently see it as red, nonetheless. This could not be clearly a mere translation of wavelength into color. There had to be some way, Helmholtz thought, of discounting the illuminant. And this he saw as an unconscious inference or an act of judgment, though he did not venture to suggest where such judgment might occur. Color constancy for him was a special example of the way in which we achieve perceptual constancy generally, make a stable perceptual world from a chaotic sensory flux, a world that would not be possible if our perceptions were merely passive reflections of the unpredictable and inconstant input that bathes our receptors. Helmholtz's great contemporary, Clerk Maxwell, had also been fascinated by the mystery of color vision from his student days. He formalized the notions of primary colors and color mixing by the invention of a color top, the colors of which fused when it was spun to yield a sensation of gray. And a graphic representation with three axes, a color triangle, which showed how any color could be created by different mixtures of the three primary colors. These prepared the way for his most spectacular demonstration, the demonstration in 1861 that color photography was possible, despite the fact that photographic emulsions were themselves black and white.